Aren't you glad to be here? Howie Stevenson worked with Chuck Swindoll for a generation at the church in Southern California. And he would always begin saying, "Aren't you glad you're here? I'm so glad I'm here. I'd rather be here than in the best hospital room in the city." And speaking of hospitals, I did have surgery in April, and it's limited my ability to speak. Preachers, Latins, and Mediterranean types, we speak with our hands and our arms. And my gestures are going to be incomplete and off-center. Two Jews are walking down the street in Brooklyn. One says, "Rabbi Shaul, you're so quiet." He says, "I can't talk." He says, "What do you mean you can't talk?" "Can't talk? Why can't you talk?" "I've hurt my arm." Anyway, I am thrilled to be here. I can't believe this. 21 years ago, Beverly and I and our daughter Rachel, who came along to help, were driving a U-Haul truck and hauling our car. And we were on our way to Dallas for me to begin teaching in the fall of 1995. And we drove through Wichita Falls, and I saw bicyclists everywhere. And then I said to Bev, "Oh, that's that big bicycle ride in Wichita Falls." And I said, "Pastor Tom Rogers had been in my class in Phoenix Seminary, and he told me about this ride. Next year, maybe I can do that ride." And I had no idea that I'd be coming to this church for 20 years. I'm just so grateful to God. Well, I'd like to talk to you today about a miracle of Jesus, as you've been having a series all summer long, I understand. And what I'm going to do is a little different take on that by talking about the great miracle of His resurrection. And before I do that, I want to show you an object that's an actual lamp from Bible Times. Not only have I come to this church a number of years, but I've been going to Israel for more than 40 years. And in my first trip with Dr. Walke, my professor, I was introduced to an antiquity dealer in Jerusalem. This is the son, who is my age, but we were introduced to his father. And the Baidun Antiquity Shop has been in business for over 50 years. And I was introduced to the senior Baidun in 1972. And my first trip, that was January. And there were 80 people from the seminary, graduates like myself and current students and some professors. And we all wanted to get something to bring home that was from Bible Times. And I remember holding my first object and finding it hard to believe that I was holding in my hand something that was very, very old. I bought a milk jug from the time of Abraham, so it was 4,000 years old, and that just seemed to me to be incredible. In subsequent years, I've gotten numerous things, and we have quite a collection now, as do many other people. But I have a collection of objects from the Chalcolithic period, 5,000 B.C., up through the 6th century of our era. And a lot of the things that I have are lamps. So I have a full history of lamps from Bible Times. And I brought one with me. This is a lamp from the Iron Age. It's a lamp from the time of David. What it is a bowl that has a pinch on one side, and the pinch allows for the wick platform. So this would be filled in Bible Times with olive oil, that was the fuel, and then the wick would be made of flax or linen or wool. And a lamp like this would burn about 3 hours. The oil, olive oil in those days, apparently was fairly crude. I say that because as the lamp progresses through time, it gets smaller and smaller, and it's covered. So lamps from the time of Jesus are quite small. And they burn about 3 hours as well. But this was this is an example of the lamp from the time of David. A little later, there was a high-tech improvement. This has kind of a rounded base, and it's kind of hard to steady it. And there must have been some spills, and olive oil was expensive. So an innovation was to make a flat base so it wouldn't rock. And those were iron two lamps for a later period. So I look at this lamp, and this is a very beautiful example of an iron one lamp. And I'm holding something that's from the time of David, 1,000 years B.C. And you wonder, well, where did this come from? Well, it did not come from an excavation. It is absolutely forbidden for archaeologists or anyone working at an excavation to sell anything. Imagine what would happen if that weren't the rule. People would be pilfering things and the evidence from a site would be destroyed. No, this was found not in an actual dig, but in a tomb. And I have a picture of a tomb I'm showing now that was found in Cush, K-U-S-H. Cush in Hebrew Bible is mistranslated as Ethiopia in the Old Testament. Translators knew that it was an African region, and they just thought that the Hebrew word Cush meant someplace in Africa, and they picked Ethiopia. But in fact, Cush turns out to be a proper name, and the region of Cush is directly south of ancient Egypt. Today, it's in southern Sudan, and an area today of horrible devastation of lives and ruining of people. It's a place in wretched condition today. But in Old Testament times, Cush was a magnificent civilization. Going back to the earliest times of civilization in the Mediterranean world. And in New Testament times, 100 years after the time of Jesus, there was a flourishing church there, and this picture was taken of a tomb that was discovered a few years ago, and this tomb is from the 4th century of our era. And I look at that tomb, and several things stand out to me. The first is the position of the body. You're looking at the skeleton, of course, but when the body was placed in this tomb, it was placed on its side and would have been wrapped in cloth soaked in resinous and perfumed ointments to cut back a bit on the odors of decomposition. But notice the position of the arms and the hands. Can you see that? If you were to right the figure, you'd see that he's on his knees and his hands are raised like this in prayer. This is the burial of a significant Christian leader in a church in Cush. We don't know who he was. He may have been a deacon. He may have been a pastor. Perhaps he was a very faithful layperson, but he was buried with great honor. His body was buried with great honor and great dignity. And the position that he's in is a position of prayer. And why is that? Because the position of his body is in anticipation of the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. The second thing I observe in this tomb is stuff. Do you see the pots and the bowls? In this case, these are all brand new. Poorer people would not put new things in a tomb. They'd put older things. So a number of the objects that I have, they've all come from tombs. A number of the lamps are charred because they've been used. And there's a black soot that's still embedded into the clay that's been baked. But in this particular tomb, there are very expensive, very beautiful pots, and each one is brand new. That's why we think that he was a wealthy man or a leader of the church, someone of great respect. And why were the pots there? As a symbol of hope in life to come. I look at this beautiful lamp. This was placed in a tomb. Someone from the time of David, give or take 50 years. And this was placed in the tomb in the hope of the resurrection from the dead. Now, what I've just said is indisputable when it comes to archaeology. But when it comes to most Bible scholars today, this would cause some, if they were here in the room, to freak out. And they would say, no, they might even interrupt the service because they are so convinced, listen to this, that Jewish people had no anticipation of resurrection or life after death until the 2nd century B.C., that they do not believe it is possible that Jewish people who believed in God looked forward to the resurrection of the body in the time of David. 140 years ago, German scholars in universities and faculties of Protestant and Catholic theology made some horrible decisions that stripped the faith from churched people in Europe. And the results include the Second World War, Nazi rise to power, Hitler's power, could not have happened in a believing people group. And the present situation in Europe, as you know, we have beautiful cathedrals, magnificently maintained, with no people in them. I was in Prague a year ago, and that's where the Reformation had one of its first glimmerings 100 years before Luther. And Jan Hus, who was the leader of Protestant thought in what today is the Czech Republic. And I was on the Acropolis of the city, where the old palace is and the great cathedral, and looked out to a spectacular view out over the city. And everywhere we looked, there were church towers and crosses, and the skyline is just besotted with church buildings, almost all of them completely empty. And our guide, I asked her, what's the percentage of Christians in the country, the Czech Republic today? And she says, oh, we are so proud. We are 97% by actual polling atheist. 97%. And what happened is German scholars stripped away confidence in the Bible beginning 140 years ago. They argued that Moses had nothing to do with the writing of the Pentateuch, that Moses never lived. They argued that Isaiah could not have written the book bearing his name, but it was written by three different people in 3 centuries. They argued that the book of Daniel is trash, should never be in the canon, that it was a false writing, a false document, a pseudepigraphal writing. They argued that David probably never existed, but even if he did, he had nothing to do with the Psalms attributed to him. And they argued that the idea of resurrection did not come to Israel until after the conquest of the Levant by Alexander the Great in the 330s, and it took a while for Hellenism, Greek philosophy and thought, to come to the land of the Bible. So Jews began to believe in the idea of resurrection, we are told, in the 2nd century, and they learned it from Greek poets. Can you believe that? So if you open your Bible to the book of Psalms, to Psalm 16, the passage I want to take you into today, the position I'm taking on this psalm is diametrically opposed to that which is taught in almost every school and university, not only in America, but in the Western and now Eastern world, because these ideas have traveled with scholars who have gone from Germany to Britain to the Americas, and then their influence is found in South America and in universities in the Far East. And when I talk about David writing the psalm, There would be people in a scholarly meeting that would laugh aloud, thinking, does he really believe that? And if I were to say that the psalm was about resurrection, they'd say only if it was written in the second century. That's how deeply embedded these ideas are. Well, I don't listen to much of that, and I hope you don't either. And I'd like to read to you Psalm 16, this magnificent psalm, which I believe was written by David. And the passage reads, "Preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust. O my soul, you have said to the Lord, you are my Lord. My goodness is nothing apart from you. As for the saints who are on the earth, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. Their sorrow shall be multiplied who hasten after another God." Verse 4. "Their drink offerings of blood I will not offer, nor take their names on my lips." Verse 5. "O Lord, you are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a good inheritance. I will bless the Lord, who has given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in the night seasons. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved." Verse 9. "Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh also rests in hope. For you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore." Psalm 16. This psalm is a psalm that was in the context of lamentation. There's a pattern for psalms of lament. And this is one thing that German scholars did discover and that we take very seriously. There was a way of writing a psalm. And a psalm of lament had a pattern to it where the psalmist would cry out to God saying, "Oh my God," that's not OMG on a text message, but really calling out to God. And then the psalmist would talk about his situation, saying that his lament proper, where he'd say, "I am hurting, and to God, you don't seem to care, and of the enemies, they are winning." And then there would be an immediate and juxtaposition with this sense of horror, with a confidence in God. We call that the confession of trust. And the psalmist that has just said, "You don't care," says, "In the depths of my heart, I know that you care for me more than I care for myself." And then come petitions, and the petitions include three ideas. One is, "I'm hurting, deliver me. You're not paying attention, listen to me. They are winning, punish them." So the three petitions match the three pronouns used in the lament. And then there's the promise, the vow of praise. "When it's all over, I will give praise to your name, when you will have brought me out of this terrible situation." So you look at this psalm, and the very first colon, David says, "Preserve me, O God," and that puts us in the context of trouble. He is in terrible trouble, and the full psalm pattern would have all the elements I've just described. But sometimes a poem is written with just one segment magnified. And this psalm takes the confession of trust, and it magnifies that, and it just shows us by the opening words, "Preserve me, O God," that it's in a context of trouble. And here, the psalmist David has an opportunity to elaborate on his confidence in God, even at a time of terrible trouble. So that's what we need to know, that this is a time of terrible trouble, but David is focused on a desire to express to God his utter confidence in him. And this psalm has four segments of unequal length. And the first movement of the psalm is verses 1 to 3. And here is where he expresses his dependence on the living God. His dependence on the living God. And verse 1 shows this in this opening word, "Preserve me, preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust." And in Old Testament language, that's the language of saving faith. He is not trusting in his own wits, his own army, his own power. He's trusting solely in God. And he's not trusting in his own goodness. In fact, look at what we have in verse 2 at the end. "My goodness is nothing apart from you." So he's trusting in the righteousness of God that has been brought upon him because of saving faith. And he's like Avram in Genesis 15, who has trusted in Yahweh, and God counts his faith to him as righteousness. So this is a remarkable presentation of the grace of God in saving faith of David. That David has come like Abraham 1,000 years before him, and you and I 3,000 years later, he's come to God in saving faith, and that saving faith means he's not trusting in anything for his deliverance. His only object of trust is the living God. And these words are absolutely wonderful. Notice his association with other believers, and I'm not going to focus on this first part, but it is remarkable. We come to the second part of the psalm, and we have David eschewing idolatry and wickedness. He has a rejection of the ways of the wicked. David was always being countered by unbelievers who were even on his senior staff. David had, as kings did in the Old Testament world, he had advisors. And those advisors, some of them shared his wonderful faith in God, but others did not. And the hope was that being around David and others of faith, that non-believing advisors would share that faith. But from time to time, we read in the Psalms, David's rejection of the advice of those who don't trust in God. We have the same thing in Psalm 40. David says in Psalm 40, "I wait entirely and solely, utterly on God and God alone." And then when God brings him out of his trouble, he turns to those advisors and he said, "You know, in the midst of my trouble, you were telling me I should turn to other gods. If God doesn't answer, there are other gods. Here's a list of them. I was in trouble one time and I prayed to this God and things worked out. Why don't you do that?" And David says in Psalm 40 to his wicked advisors, "What you need to know is the only truly blessed life is that life that is focused entirely on God and God alone." And look at what he says here in verse 4. "Their sorrows will be multiplied who run after another God." And he's being told, turn to another. "No, I won't do that, because that's the way to ensure defeat." He says, "Their drink offerings of blood I'll not offer, nor take their names on my lips." The drink offering has to do, see, I got to support this, has to do with the pouring of beer or wine on an altar of sacrifice. And beer and wine were a way of magnifying the offering. But he says, I know what fluids they're using, but I know what they're trusting in. And it's disgusting. It's like blood. It's repellent. I will eschew this entirely. And I'll never even name their names in a context of worship. If you ever hear me talk about Baal, it will be with disgust and revulsion. So here is David's complete commitment to living God. It's absolutely wonderful. And then we come to the next part, where he talks about his desire to experience the deliverance of God and the blessings of God. I've just backed up the wrong way. This is going to be easy to fix, isn't it? There it is, enjoying the blessings of God. An uneven section, a long section, verses 5 to 9. And look at these words. O Lord, you are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. So he's talked about the idea that they're pouring libations on altars, but his cup is found in God and God alone. And in verse 6 he says, the lines, these are boundary lines, have fallen to me in pleasant places, and I have a good inheritance, and my life is going to be one of praising God, blessing God, trusting God. Verse 8, I've set Yahweh always before me, and because he is at my right hand, I'll not be moved. And the right hand is a powerful image. In Bible times, it doesn't matter whether you're naturally left or right-handed, everyone on the battlefield was right-handed. And you would carry your offensive weapon in the right hand, and the shield would be in your left. And as soldiers would line up at the beginning of a battle, my shield covers my left side, but it also protects the guy on my who is to my left, because on his right, that's where he has his spear or his sword. And what David is saying, at my right hand, at my right side, there's the protection of the shield of glory. It is God there, the Lord Yahweh. He is battling beside me, and he's protecting me. Now, I'm rushing to get to the end of the psalm, and this is verses 9 to 11. This is the payoff part of this magnificent psalm. There are other psalms that say many of the same things that we've seen so far, but this psalm is unique in its statement in verses 9 to 11. And what I'm about to say, again, many, many scholars would just chuckle or laugh or walk out of the room. But I look at these words and I see David's confident faith in God, that should he die in the battle, that is not the end of his life, that he's going to be placed in a tomb. And in his tomb, because he's the king, there will be marvelous things placed in the tomb alongside the body. Things like a lamp, and this lamp is from his time period. I'd like to tell you this is a lamp of David, but that would be a lie. Maybe it's a lamp of Caleb, though. I don't know. But anyway, it's a lamp that was a significant person. And these sorts of things would be placed in the tomb as a hope, a physical symbol of hope in the resurrection. So look at the wording that we have in verse 9. Therefore my heart is glad, my glory rejoices, my flesh will rest in hope. David hopes, he prays, he earnestly desires that he will survive this present crisis, that God will get him out of it, that God will deliver him through it, that he will not die, but that he will live through this experience as he's lived through so many others in times past. But he knows the possibility is there, for he knows one who lives by the sword, oh, look at that, is likely to die by the sword. That's not supposed to happen. This is really wonderful. And it is. I can't believe it. So anyway, he knows that this is a problem, that he might die. But look at what he says. My heart is glad. My glory rejoices. There's a bit of a joke there. The word translated glory is actually the word liver. Kavod, the word is liver. And he's speaking about his internal organs. And he's saying, my heart, that represents his inner being, his liver, that represents the organs of his body, and his flesh, same word that we have, basar is flesh, and he's saying, that if I were to die, I will rest in hope, and the rest there would be burial, the burial of his body, and my rest will be in hope. Do you see that? That is, a believing Hebrew person in the time of David had the idea that this life is not the end. And when the body is placed in a tomb, and the body is clearly dead, and there's going to be putrefaction, there's going to be decomposition, there will be within a year utter skeletonization. And at the end of a year, they'd roll the tombstone away, and loving people would go in and collect the bones, and they would put the bones in a back recess in the family tomb, and bones would be added to bones, and that's where we get the idea in the Bible of one sleeping with his fathers. As bones are added to bones, and the bones are added to bones, and objects are added to objects, all in hope of the resurrection. One day, those bones are going to be brought back to life by God. And that's why he talks about his heart and his physical organs and his flesh. That flesh that decays goes through decomp, putrefaction. These aren't pleasant things, but that's what happens. God's going to put that all together. And this is a statement of his hope in life to come. And verse 10, he says, I know that you will not leave my soul. Now, when we have the word my soul in the Psalms, usually the psalmist is not talking about an inanimate part of himself, but my soul in the Psalms is a substitute for the personal pronoun, me. You'll not leave me in Sheol. That's really what he's saying. And Sheol is a mysterious word in the Bible. We don't fully know what it means. That's why it's transliterated. Sheol is a Hebrew word. And it means the realm of the dead. And some people say the realm of the dead is a ghastly idea. But what did they know? And so they had this word that describes the region of dead people. But by using the word Sheol, what he's saying clearly is that at death, it's not over, that he will live again. And so he says, you won't leave me in Sheol, and you'll not allow, New King James says, your Holy One to see corruption. The word Holy One here is not the word holy, as we would ordinarily find it. That's the word kadosh. But this is from the word meaning one who's completely devoted to God. It's related to the Hebrew word chesed, loyal love. It's the word chassid, and it means someone who is so devoted to God that he or she is representing the character quality of God, loyalty and love. And he says, it can't be over when my life is over because God cannot forget me. As Jesus told unbelieving Sadducees in Matthew 22, God is the God of the living. And then he astonishes us, Jesus does, when he says, you know that verse in Exodus 3 that identifies God, the God of Moses, as the God of the ancestors, the God of the fathers. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. That by those words, Jesus explains that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were present with God because God's not the God of dead people, but of living people. Isn't that amazing? And David says, you'll not leave me in Sheol. And then verse 10, this is just overwhelming. Verse 10, he says, you're going to bring me to an experience of the path of life. Do you see that word? The path of life. When I die, it's not over. But you're going to bring me to the path of life. And where will I be? I'll be in your presence, because in your presence is fullness of joy. And what it will be like at your right hand, no longer in battle, but now in glory, are pleasures forevermore. This section of this psalm cuts across the corrupt thought of German scholars 140 years ago, and it says that they are absolutely in error when they say that Hebrew people had no view of afterlife or resurrection. They thought David couldn't have written Psalms because the poetry is too beautiful for someone in the 10th century B.C. Kenneth Kitchen laughs at that. He's published a book on ancient Egyptian poetry that goes back to 3000 B.C., 2 millennia before the time of David, and the poetry in Egypt 1,000 years before David is every bit as beautiful as any poetry in the Bible. And now we have the poetry from Ugarit in far north Syria. The city was destroyed in 1200 B.C., and we use the poetry from Ugarit to help us understand the poetry in the Bible. And that's at least 200 years before David, and some of that up to 500 years before. It's absolutely silly to say David could not have written this psalm. It's only based on disbelief. It's absolutely silly to say that David didn't believe in the resurrection. Thousands and thousands and thousands of objects, like the lamp I showed you, are testimony against the folly of that idea. So when I read this psalm, I think, first of all, this is the hope of David. It's the hope of David for his personal resurrection. But this psalm was sung in the congregation. And when this song was sung by Hebrew people in the courtyards of the temple, they were all singing this song, those of faith, with the same spirit that David had had. They're saying, when I die, it will not be over for me either, any more than it was over for Abraham, any more than it was over for David. It will not be over for me either, because I share the same faith as Abraham and David and countless others. So this became the shared possession of the faith of Hebrew people, that when I die, I will live again. And each person put his or her own name here. My heart is glad, and my glory rejoices, and my flesh will rest in hope. You will not leave me in Sheol, but you will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. And the ultimate meaning of this psalm is found in the resurrection of Jesus. And I'd like to have you turn just for a moment to the New Testament book of Acts, chapter 2. You didn't know it. My Bible has a New Testament as well. And Acts chapter 2, the preaching of Peter on Pentecost. Peter does something really unusual with this psalm. He kind of plays a game with it, but if we know what he's doing, it's really remarkable. He said to those who were wondering about what he and the believers in the upper room had come to believe, he says, beginning at verse 22, he says, men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know, and you know that he was delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, and you've taken by lawless hands, crucified and put to death, whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be held by it. And then he quotes this passage from this psalm. And then he says something really remarkable. He says, ultimately, This psalm was not written about David because, although it's not true today, it apparently was true in Peter's day, they knew where the tomb of David was. And because David's material remains, his skeleton, would still be in that tomb, David had not yet been physically resurrected. But Jesus has been. And he says the ultimate meaning of this psalm is found in the resurrection of Jesus, because Jesus is alive, and his soul, verse 31, was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God has raised up, of which we are all witnesses. And Peter takes this psalm, which speaks of the personal hope of David for his own resurrection. He takes this psalm, which had been used by countless thousands of people in the hope of their ultimate resurrection, and he now applies it to Jesus, and he says, this psalm was the hope of Jesus as well. But in the case of Jesus, there's not waiting 100 years or 1,000 years or God knows how many years until the general resurrection. No, in Jesus' case, he's the firstborn. He's the one first to come from the tomb. He's the first one to live in resurrection joy. And look at Jesus. We've seen him, and he is alive. And we know that he's alive in heaven today. And he appeared among us. He appeared among many. And then God took him to heaven, and he's now at the right hand of the Father in a place of exalted honor. And your hope of resurrection is solidified by the reality of the reaction of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. Isn't that terrific? You have ill people in this church, you have people in this congregation who die. We do. All of us face that. Look again at these words, verses 9 to 11. While the ultimate meaning is in Jesus, the immediate meaning is in our own lives. You and I, in the midst of terrible trouble, accident, disease, illness, or just the progress of aging, can say there's coming a time when my body will be laid to rest in a tomb, or these days, body can even be cremated. These days, we don't put objects in the tomb usually, though some do. But we know, because we believe in God, as David did, that one day our body will be put back together and we will be in the presence of God. Look at verse 11. This is the hope of the for the future of every believing person. To God, you will show me the path of life. In your presence will be the fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. This is our hope. This is our confidence. We share with David the blessed hope of the resurrection and present of God in our future. So we pray, dear Father, that our confidence would be like the confidence of David, like the confidence of Abraham, the confidence of unknown people, unknown to us, but known to you, and the confidence that led Jesus to go to the cross and to endure the pain and physical death, and then to experience the glory of the resurrection. This we share by your grace in Jesus' name. Amen.